At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hello everyone and welcome back to episode 197 of your favourite Formula One show. Yes, Jamie and I return, still in the depths of F1's autumn break. And today, we're going back into the depths of the F1 iceberg. Yes, we haven't done one of these in a very, very long time. We've got just 2 levels to go of the F1 iceberg. So yeah, Jamie and I are returning today with 8 more. Less and, well, what we found, haven't we, Jamie, is that the further down we go, the more difficult it is to find any information on any of this.
Yeah. Yeah, which I guess is the point of an iceberg. Hello, everyone, by the way. Nice to be introduced this week. yeah, the whole point is that the deeper you go, the less and less information you can find. So we spent, or certainly I've spent, a decent amount of time trying to find anything about some of these on the F1 iceberg, which is, Matt's got a link in the description, which is now a job he's got to remember to do. So yeah, we're going to get into it. There's not as many as there were at the top of the iceberg, but the ones that we do have, we'll do our best to shed some light on.
Yes. So where do you want to start this time around then, Jamie? Should we? I mean, we'll preface this as well. Viewer discretion is advised. There are some, I mean, this is Formula One. A lot of these are quite old. There are some dark stories in today's F1 iceberg that some viewers might find distressing. So just be careful. You know, I would say this one might not be the best one to perhaps watch whilst eating a meal, for example. Or as you go to bed. Maybe just wait for
F1 in the 60s and 70s is not, you know, there's a lot going on there.
It was pretty insane, wasn't it? I mean, should we go even further back than the 60s or 70s, though, Jamie? Do you want to start with what's lovingly called the Jean Behra punch?
Yes, I can start with that one. There's a guy called Jean Behra. He's a driver. He's not alive anymore, is he? This is a long time ago. And yes, he was racing in Formula One back in the 50s. He drove for a few teams, including Ferrari. He is entering the 1959 Italian Grand Prix, no, French Grand Prix at Reims, or Rem, for those French inclined. And he's had a bad start to the race. He is, he's down at the back because he didn't start the race. Like, he stalled and then was basically last from there on. He got going and he's a pretty good driver. So, you know, 20 laps in, this is the 50s, cars lasted about 10 laps most of the time. But after 20 laps, he's gone from last to up to P3, which would be all over social media these days. But this is 1959. And then not long after this, he'd got up to third in 20 laps. His Ferrari retired from the race because it was smoking. The engine had gone. And then an engineer called Tavoni, who I will try and find the first name of. It is Romulo. Romulo Tavoni.
I assume he's Italian. 1950s names. Incredible.
Exactly. He'd suggested that Jean Behra had caused his own retirement by over-revving the engine many times, causing it to fail. And it's not like anyone on this podcast has ever suggested that some drivers retire themselves because they over-rev or drive the car wrong, looking at Singapore 2017. Is it, Matt?
No, of course not.
So Jean Behra didn't take this well, as you might expect. And with a single punch, I quote, with a single punch, Behra felled Tavoni. And Tavoni's on the floor, punched in the face, or punched somewhere, probably in the face.
It was in the face.
And within hours, Jean Behra's Ferrari contract has been liquidated and he's no longer got any drive for the rest of the season. This is 1959, so you can drive for a different team every race if you really want to. There's no real long-term contracts. So he's obviously upset, probably, about losing his seat. He tries to make amends The next race by driving for BRM, or he's working on a contract with BRM for the German Grand Prix at one of my personal favourite racetracks ever, the Arvisring. There's some deep lore of this podcast. He turns up to Arvis hoping to drive for BRM. Sadly, the contract doesn't go through in time, so he can't drive for BRM. So instead, Jean Berra, just does the big man thing of turning up with his own F2 Porsche and enters the race with his own car because no one employed him for that race. So Ferrari sacked him. He tries to go to BRM, couldn't go to BRM, and then he turns up in his own car. it didn't go great for him. But yeah.
Well, I believe as well, not long after this, he did die, didn't he? In a crash as well.
He did. I will do some research.
But, I mean, Formula One back in the 1950s was absolute insanity. I think that story, again, I mean, you would not get that story in any other era in Formula One.
No.
Something just as bizarrely wild as that.
No, you really wouldn't. That was actually his final race in Formula One. He entered in 1959. He did three races with Ferrari and one race under Jean Berra.
Nice.
In the Berra Porsche RSK. And that was it for him.
Never got to race again. And I mean, even to this day, I mean, the older drivers, when you kind of talk about, you know, the drivers that are still alive from like the 70s and stuff, Jean Berra apparently pretty much broke every bone in his body at some point or another. He was absolutely insane, the fact he was still racing. Mm. And, well, we know how dangerous Formula One was back in the 50s and 60s. It was a miracle he made it to the end of the 1950s, to be completely honest. Where do we want to move next, Jamie?
Should we go for one of yours?
Yeah, we'll go with one of mine. Which one of mine do you... Jamie basically doesn't know anything about any of mine, so he's basically...
I'm looking forward to this. I'm learning as much as you guys at home are. Which is the most lighthearted? We should go from top to bottom.
I would say the McLaren Penske fuel controversy is easily the most lighthearted of the four I've got today.
Okay, go for that.
Well, I mean, let's kick this one off. Obviously, Formula One nowadays, occasionally, you know, we like to joke about, you know, Red Bull avoiding any major penalty with a cost cap in 2022, or Red Bull not getting retroactively disqualified from the 2023 F1 season for their weird rear brake balance. And, you know, Ferrari...
McLaren having flexi wings.
Exactly, McLaren having flexible wings and all this, that and the other, or Mercedes with DAS and everything. But of course, it wasn't that long ago that, obviously, the FIA is lovingly known as the Ferrari International Assistance. Now, obviously, now you would make the argument that maybe Ferrari don't have as much control over the FIA as many people are led to believe. The McLaren-Penske fuel controversy was certainly the time where it's believed that Ferrari had slightly more sway over Formula One. The year is 1976, Jamie. This is actually the weekend Niki Lauda came back to Formula One, obviously after his horrendous crash at the Nürburgring. Now, heading into the weekend, I believe he's still got a 2-point buffer over James Hunt, who of course has been on a tear whilst Niki Lauda has been out of the sport. Now, obviously, famously, Ferrari didn't want Lauda back in the car for the Italian Grand Prix, but he said otherwise, you know, he wanted to try and fight for this world championship. So got back in the car. Now, the way qualifying used to work in the 1970s was that in both Friday and Saturday, you could try and set your best lap time. And it basically just worked that obviously your fastest time from either one was the time that stuck. Which of course, obviously, on a lot of weekends wouldn't give you any problems. But obviously on weekends where track conditions, say, evolved or got better or got worse, one of those sessions might be more important than the other. Friday at Monza... absolutely bucketed it down. It was a very wet session. No one could really get much representative running. Saturday was a much drier affair. So basically, obviously, every team knew their best shot to try and set a good qualifying time was going to be on Saturday. Qualifying ends. Everything is all right. You know, Hunt and Lauda both have made it through. Neither of them had particularly great qualifying sessions, but both have made it through, as well as both of the Penske drivers. Now, obviously, nowadays in Formula 1, personnel for the FIA are shipped all around the world, aren't they? Back in the 70s, you kind of had a few people from the FIA at every Grand Prix, and then a lot of it was done by national automobile clubs. It was deemed at the end of Saturday's qualifying session that both McLaren and Penske had exceeded the permissible octane limit on their fuel. Now, when McLaren and Penske went to lodge a complaint about this and they asked for the evidence, the Italians kind of went, "We don't have any evidence, we're just saying that's the case." Which, we're not going to claim that maybe they were slightly on the side of Ferrari here, but all the evidence supports that that was most likely the case. In the end, it meant that they... So, obviously, both of the McLaren drivers and the Penskes had to start at the back of the field, because all their qualifying times from Friday were the ones that were used, and in the end, Lauda would pick up 3 vital world championship points whilst Hunt walked away from that weekend with absolutely nothing. But of course, yeah, come the end of the season, as we all know, James Hunt would still win the Formula One World Championship. So, very, very controversial in the moment, in what was a very, very controversial season, didn't actually end up changing too much.
No, it's one of those where you had Lauda won the championship, they might have been a bit more salty about. But it's a fun story. Penske and a blast from the past. Don't hear that much about them anymore.
Not in Europe. They do a lot in the US in still.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, that's beyond my recollection.
Fair enough. Cool.
Well, what should we move on to?
Where do you want to go?
I want to do well by racing, because this is a mess, I'm going to be honest.
We both tried to research this one. It was by far and away the most difficult one to try and get any information about. It's so odd.
Yeah, the upshot is, as far as I can tell, Team Lotus, which is the famous team from the early, like, 60s and 70s, with, like, Jim Clark, Emerson Fittipaldi, the John Player Special Lotus livery, that kind of iconic era. You think in that team. 1970 season, they turn up. For some reason, they've entered 5 drivers over the course of the season. Jochen Rindt, who was the world champion that year, and the only posthumous world champion in F1 history, he was killed in qualifying in one of the final races of the season, but he had a lead big enough that he still won the championship, and his wife collected the trophy for him. He's driving for them, along with a guy called John Miles, who I know nothing about. He's got a Wikipedia page, but that's about it. A Spanish guy called Alex Soler-Roig, Emerson Fittipaldi, who I do know something about, and a Swedish guy called René Wiesel. So they're the 5 drivers, and for some reason, and this is where it kind of falls apart, they've entered the season with 3 different title sponsors, or kind of names. So they've got Gold Leaf Team Lotus, which Gold Leaf was the brand of John Player Special, which is tobacco. That is one of their title sponsors. They've also got Garvey Team Lotus, which is another tobacco sponsorship. And this third one, Worldwide Racing, which is not Lotus in the slightest. And it's quite hard to tell which races they entered as Worldwide Racing. All I know is that the Spanish guy, Alex Soler-Roig, he did Belgium and France under this name. Don't know why. The rest, like, Rindt and his teammate for most of the season, John Miles, entered all the races under Team Lotus. I do wonder if it's something to do with tobacco sponsorship law in Spain, but that's complete conspiracy. I have no idea.
Well, Spanish still smoke like chimneys today. Why would that have been a problem?
Yeah. It's true. And Alex Soler-Roig did enter one race as Team Lotus in Spain, ironically. And then the rest of the season, he didn't. Yeah, I don't know what it was, but there's some deeper lore going on here. We don't know. Well, I don't know what it is.
This is so far down the iceberg, Jamie and I genuinely couldn't work out what on earth it was. I originally thought when I read it, Jamie, that it was the 2009 Breakaway F1 series, but I was completely wrong with that. Yeah, we've already discussed that.
Yeah, that was called something else, wasn't it?
But yeah, it was bizarre.
Yeah, but fun fact about World of Racing, they did enter, as in 1971 and 72, Lotus did a very similar thing. Yep. 1971, World of Racing ran a... what did I say it was?
Oh, a turbine right car. Up here.
A turbine car, gas turbine, instead of internal combustion. Yeah. Which is crazy. That must have been very explosive.
Well, yeah.
And they never finished a race with it, which is not that surprising, really. And, yeah, That was quite cool. I just thought, how on earth?
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm right in saying as well, they only ever won one Grand Prix, and it was the last one they ever entered.
Yeah. Yeah, which is odd. I mean, yeah, try and do your own research. This is some homework for our listeners and viewers. We couldn't find
anything. Make your own podcast is basically what we're saying. Yeah, that one we couldn't work out very well at all. But it does segue quite nicely, Jamie, because I'm going to talk about another race from 1970. This was the Mexican Grand Prix, which I believe was the first ever Mexican Grand Prix.
I believe it was.
It was the final race of the 1970 Formula One World Championship, which of course, yeah, it did mean that Jochen Rindt was obviously crowned world champion, despite the fact that Jackie Eakes won the race. It was carnage, to put it simply. Originally, I think they planned for about 80 to 90,000 people to show up. It's still hosted at exactly the same venue as they race in Mexico today. And Pedro Rodriguez was a bit of a local hero. So the 80 or 90,000 they expected to show up, obviously Mexico City is the biggest Spanish-speaking country in the world. I don't even know. The population of Mexico City is insane.
Yeah, it is.
200,000 people showed up. I don't know what happened to pre-sale ticketing online or what. but basically, the race was originally meant to start at 2:30 in the afternoon. It didn't start until 4 o'clock. And they basically just put humans in everywhere. As in, I'm talking behind guardrails, on the edge of the circuit, and on the edge of the track, around the entire
venue.
Like
where marshals only
Closer. See, literally just the other side of a white line on the track. It led to a lot of problems. Jackie Stewart tried obviously to get the race cancelled because, of course, he was very safety conscious. And even there were instances and cases of people running across the track itself whilst the race was on. It did lead to Mexico or the Mexican Grand Prix being scrapped for another 15 years afterwards. And it caused the race to be delayed by an hour and a half. But as far as I can tell, staggeringly, there were no injuries or fatalities or anything because of it. It was just chaos.
Certainly there's no recorded injuries or fatalities.
No, but you think something like that would probably get picked up.
Yes, you would. You would. And in honour of Pedro Rodriguez, they named the track after
him.
They
did.
So, yeah, which is still with us today until Checo Perez drops off on the grid and it's gone. Yeah. Do we think Perez is going to announce his retirement at Mexico, by the way?
He apparently has said no, so he's not going to announce it there, but he's going to get sacked at the end of the year.
Nah, it's not happening. It's not happening at all. It happens every year when they say he's going to retire.
Yep.
And he never does.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll move on to the one of mine isn't, which is the non-dark one.
You're both of you. No, the Italian GP boycott. No, Italian,
yeah.
It's not that dark.
Let's do 1960 Italian Grand Prix because we'll save the darkness for a time to come.
I think the last
Italian Grand Prix, 1960. We've got, it's obviously Italy, so a lot of Ferrari fans are there, even in the 60s. We're 10 years into the sport, into Formula One, and the track kind of the picture of Formula One at this point, there's no like rules. You kind of just go around the world and each track kind of has their own regulations for what a track can
there's
be.
There's no FIA
grading.
Which
is why
grading.
You get stuff. Yes, exactly. So, you know, you go to Arvis, second mention of the day, and you've got, is it a 45 degree banking?
35, like I think, yeah.
35 degree banking. And stuff like that. And for context, the one at Zandvoort, which is the biggest one now, is something like 12, I thought,
but I could be wrong. I could be completely out.
Yeah, it's definitely much, much lower, and everyone makes that out to be a crazy banking. I've actually been to the banking at Monza, which this is about, and you genuinely can barely
walk
up it.
It's insane, isn't it?
Yeah. Like, it's quite a big challenge to get to the top of the banking on foot. But yeah, you're going to drive some fast cars around there in 1960, of course you are. But some British teams in Italy are not very happy about it. So you've got all of the kind of big, like, this is an era for British motorsport, really. So, you know, you've got the likes of Cooper, BRM, Lotus, as we spoke about, or Worldwide Racing, as they're sometimes known, clearly. They're all here, and they're all a bit upset. So they have turned up to Monza, and they basically boycott the race because they don't want to drive on the banking. It also makes it a 10-kilometer track, which is crazy. You might see the map of Monza these days with the banking, with the oval on it. The oval is actually part of the track. So they're doing Monza as we know it, and then at Parabolica, you kind of turn onto the oval and do an oval that rejoins back on the main straight. It's kind of mad. And it was 500 kilometers, 50 laps, and it took him almost 3 hours. So big change from Monza from these days. And there's only about 2 breaking points from what I can see on this track. But yeah, they threatened this boycott. Monza refused to budge. And therefore, you had those three teams, BRM, Lotus, and Cooper, all of them boycotted the race. Although I'm looking, Cooper actually did enter it.
Cooper did enter the Grand Prix. You're forgetting one other important bit, Jamie, about this story, which seems to have gone past your research. Ferrari in 1960 were awful. They were terrible that year because they were still using a front-engine car. Whereas obviously all the British teams had gone to rear-engine because obviously they knew it was the way forward. Ferrari had one thing in their back pocket still, and that was straight-line speed. This was the first time the oval banking had been used at Monza. Basically, like we mentioned with the other one that I spoke about earlier on with the McLaren-Penske fuel controversy, this was the precursor to that. In 1960, it was just so Ferrari could win. And they did end up getting a 1-2-3 out of it.
Yeah, yeah. Because of anyone who entered the race, none of them had ever won a Grand Prix before.
Yep, insane stuff.
Which is crazy, because all the Grand Prix winners drove for the teams who boycotted. Yep. So nowadays, you know, in Belgium, I think we had 11
winners,
Grand Prix winners in the top 11 on the finishing positions until George Russell got disqualified. Yep. There were none on the whole grid. That is crazy. So you know, you're going into a race and you know you're going to have a debut winner. That's like, who would you even have on a grid these days of non-winners? Be like Hülkenberg.
Obviously Hülkenberg.
Tsunoda.
Tsunoda, Magnussen.
Albon. Colapinto.
Not many, is there?
That would pretty much be it. Joe.
The sergeant's not there anymore. Joe.
There wouldn't be many.
Yeah, there's really Stroll. Not many non... Lance Stroll. Lance Stroll.
Yeah.
That's mad, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that would really,
how
that would
few
really
there
be
are
it.
On the grid now that haven't won a race.
Yeah, I guess Liam Lawson technically would be there. And Hülkenberg would obviously win that race, and naturally that would be great.
Would he?
But yeah, 1960 Italian Grand Prix, very, very strange.
Well, I'm going to take us forward, Jamie. We're going to stay in Italy for our next one. We are going to fast forward to 2002 for one of the weird... So basically, you know how we spoke about Fernando Alonso? And obviously his 20... Mm-hmm. No, was it 2016 or 2015? I think it was 2015, wasn't it?
It was 2015.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, obviously he was... we still don't know to this day what happened to Fernando Alonso.
I think he got electrocuted.
The growing consensus is that he got electrocuted by the car. Obviously Honda's first attempt at a modern F1 power unit. This was basically that before that. So James Courtney, the famous Australian supercar driver, I believe, throughout most of his career... in 2002, was competing in British Formula 3. He was championship leader, at this part of the season. He was doing some F1... I think it was his first ever serious F1 testing in the Jaguar R3, carrying out testing for the 2003 car that would be, you know, obviously used for the next season. When down in towards the Ascari chicane, he had a catastrophic rear suspension failure, hit the wall at over 300 kilometres an hour, and then again with the rear of the car at just over 80 kilometres an hour. According to an article by Autosport, which staggeringly hasn't been taken down to this day, and I'll tell you why it's staggering in a second, he had both the front and rear wing were destroyed, all four wheels were removed from the car during the impact. The weird bit, though, Autosport reported this, it's never been taken down. They claim he was uninjured in the crash. James Courtney recalls that he was paralysed on one half of his body for an entire year after this incident. Mm. It was obviously, since Senna's death in the 90s, one of the biggest, and obviously before Jules in 2014, which of course obviously 10 years over the weekend, which is staggering to think about as well, this was one of... the rare instances in kind of that 20-year window where it really looked like someone was going to die in a Formula One car. And obviously, yeah, completely set his career back. And obviously, he spoke about it to great lengths ever since then. But the bit that kind of makes this quite deep down on the iceberg, of course, as we know, obviously, it was a rear suspension failure. But still, a lot of the detail around it remains very hidden, even to this day.
Yeah, I'm seeing 67G.
Yeah.
Which is almost as much as what Max Verstappen had when Lewis Hamilton put in the barrier.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a bit crazy. And to be fair to him, he's still racing today in Australian supercars. And he said, I'm reading a quote here, that at that point, so this is during his migraines that he got whenever he did anything, like any
getting
kind
up
of,
and walking around.
Yeah, he couldn't sit up without having a migraine. He said, at that point, he said he would never be scared of having a crash again, stating, it's over if you're scared, it's all or nothing, which I think is really cool. Obviously, horrendous for you to have a crash like this, but the fact that you can get back on the horse, as it were, is mad, and mad respect to him for that.
Yeah, and many people as well might have seen in more recent years, he's had some horrendous crashes as well. He had a incident at the Sydney 500, I believe it was, quite a few years ago. And then there's footage as well that even Jamie might have seen of when he got T-boned in the driver's side door in a V8 supercar race at Phillip Island that completely ripped that side of the car.
I think I have seen that.
Horrendous slow-mo footage that they re-showed of it. But
is he a cat or is he a human?
Well, that is a big question, isn't it?
That's a very good question.
What is you got that one more, I believe, Jamie.
I do have one more, and it's
we're really getting dark now, ladies and gents.
We are getting dark because the year is 1962. We're at Monaco, which is always a good start. It's race 2 of 9 back in the 60s, and Monaco in these days, I actually found some really cool footage, like remastered, modernized footage that is from the race, 1962, because video footage, video recording was just about a thing at this point. And yeah, you should go watch it. Not the crash, which isn't on the footage, but the footage generally is really cool because you got so close to the cars. I mean, it's horrendously dangerous because they're driving literally. Imagine Monaco. But there's not an F1 race there. So Monaco in normal times, where it's just a compact city, and then drive a very fast car through it, through the streets. And there's lampposts, there's high raised curbs, there's drain covers, there's no barriers. In the 50s, someone ended up in the sea.
Two separate drivers ended up in the sea, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's kind of the vibe. And yeah, we've got lap one of the Monaco Grand Prix. The first corner is actually effectively Raskas, or what it was back then, which was more like a hairpin. They started between Tabac and Raskas on a straight there, because it's the old configuration, but it's very similar. It's quite very like close enough to being the same track now. And a guy called Willy Mares, who drives for Ferrari, has got a good start from fourth, actually led into the first corner, which is in Monaco ridiculous. I mean, the car's tiny, but still to go from fourth to first, pretty good going. But then in all the excitement, he braked too late and spun at the first corner, which is a hairpin, and the concertina of everyone trying to avoid this sideways car ends up in more and more collisions, and ultimately a few drivers retire from the race, but more importantly, a tyre is dislodged from Richie Ginter's BRM. And this, obviously, there's no such thing as wheel tethers back in these days. There's barely wheels. And one of the wheels goes flying off and strikes a marshal, Ange Baldoni. And he is killed on lap one. And as far as I can tell, the race didn't stop. And they definitely carried on. And 100 laps of Monaco, when it's the same length as it is now, basically. We obviously do 78 laps these days. They did 100 in much slower cars. So it took them 3 hours. Bruce McLaren ended up winning the race for Cooper. ahead of two Ferraris, Phil Hill and Bandini. But yes, a marshal was killed and they didn't even really notice, which is very sad and really shows how times have changed.
Well, the show didn't stop, did it, back then?
No. Jim Clark's first ever pole position that race as well, which is a fun fact from a not very fun weekend.
Yes, yeah. And I mean, our final one as well doesn't really get much more fun, Jamie. But I will segue quickly. Whilst you mentioned that about, obviously, the race length at Monaco, I was thinking about this a couple of days ago. I think Formula One need to vary the race lengths more.
I kind of agree.
I do kind of agree. I think there should be
race lengths.
Because they're
all 300k, aren't they?
Exactly. They're all, apart from Monaco, obviously, which is about 260. I think Monaco now should be like a 50-lap race, but then there should be other ones that are longer than the current maximum, with the potential refueling allowed.
Because the problem is they keep adapting all the tracks to be better for overtaking, yeah. So he's getting rid of low speed corners.
Exactly, and every race ends in an hour and 20 minutes now.
Yeah, because the cars are so fast. You almost wonder if you just... Yeah. But I guess longer races would mean fuel tanks need to increase and that kind of annoying rubbish.
Or
like
you allow refueling again, but just put more restrictions on it. Put more restrictions on it. Or, to be fair, if you rely more on battery tech, you won't even need to do that.
Yeah.
You just, some races have to lean more on the battery than others.
That'd be cool.
That would be quite interesting.
And then that adds a level of the element strategy using your energy, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Our final one, though, Jamie, again, is another bit of a tricky one to kind of work out exactly what it's referencing. Because our final topic of conversation today is Zolder track resurfacing. Now, obviously, most people don't know this, but Spa has not hosted every Belgian Grand Prix. In fact, by the end of the 70s, Spa was obviously deemed too dangerous because it was still on the old school circuit, you know, around the town and things.
Yeah.
That was basically six miles of flat out. A bit like
Which
Monza.
You can still drive on Forza or on Project Cars.
Project Cars a few years ago had the full version of it.
That was quite fun. Yeah, but you can literally drive into someone's front door if you want
Pretty
to.
Pretty much,
crazy.
Yeah. And I'm sure people near enough did back in the late 70s.
Yeah.
So by the end of the 1970s, Spa was out. And Zolder was in. Now, Zolder actually nowadays is... It's weirdly making a bit of a comeback. For those of you that only really watch Formula 1, the best reference I can probably give is when Top Gear raced the Germans. Beat them on the last... That's Zolder, for those of you that don't really know anywhere else. That's probably the most, like, well-known reference I can probably give.
Yeah. Belgium's second best-known race.
Exactly. Exactly. But basically, obviously, by the time the 80s rolled around, obviously, Formula 1, as we know it, had basically become more dangerous again. Obviously, the speeds had continued to rise, and track safety hadn't, quite simply. So, obviously, there was new rules coming in. Obviously, we had all of the other politics going on as well, you know, with the FISA FOCA war and everything. It was just a pretty dark time, generally, in Formula 1, where everyone kind of hadn't really got their act together. But basically, new suspension, there were rules mandating, obviously, suspension because, obviously, we'd had the ground effect era of the late 70s, and teams were starting to stumble on the idea of active suspension before Williams really kind of nailed it down in the early 1990s. So Zolder had been resurfaced badly, is the only way I can word it. Obviously in the lead up to the 1981 Grand Prix, it was incredibly bumpy, incredibly dangerous, and a pretty fast racetrack as well for that time, with not much kind of room. It was a bit like Monaco, but a lot quicker, with barriers that, you know, that were right up towards the edges of the circuit. Combined with the fact, obviously, the cars were getting quicker, but they just outlawed a huge amount of kind of the active control over suspension and things. Which obviously made the cars even more of a handful because, of course, you know, people had worked out running the car as low to the ground was still by far and away the quickest way of going about things. But the worst bit around Zolder, that weekend was just how bad the facilities were in the pit lane. Now, there was meant to be over 1,000 people in the pit lane. There was one toilet block, for example, which should give you an idea of just how bad the facilities were. It was just simply not cut out for Formula One racing. Now, in Friday practice, a mechanic down at the Acela team fell off of the pit wall. He was trying to come down some stairs, which were far too narrow, fell onto the pit lane, and Carlos Reutemann basically had the option of either running him over, his name was Giovanni Amadeo, or running over a load of other pit crew. So, of course, obviously...
So it is literally the moral dilemma playing
exactly.
out.
Exactly.
You know, the one where it's like, would you flick the lever?
Yeah. For those train tracks. So he picked, obviously, he couldn't really do anything else about it. But yeah, he unfortunately, obviously, had to run over Giovanni Amadeo because he didn't have time to stop. Fractured his skull and would die on the Monday after the Grand Prix. But basically, Rob Reutemann then ended up winning, going on to win that race as well. But basically, it just culminated in the idea that Zolder was far too dangerous to host a Formula One Grand Prix. Far too narrow. The facilities weren't up to scratch. And unfortunately, they didn't really learn their lesson in 1981. By 1982, Formula One lost potentially one of its greatest ever drivers that never quite got to their full potential. When Gilles Villeneuve was famously killed in his Ferrari. The car cartwheeling into the air and tossing him out of it back then as well. He broke his neck. It's highly believed he was killed at the scene of the accident, but he was only pronounced dead later that evening.
Because if you pronounce someone dead on a racetrack, then you have to stop
the race weekend.
You mustn't stop.
Exactly. It's a similar situation to Senna in the 90s.
Yeah, 94, yeah. Yeah, it was. There was another incident that same race, that same weekend, with a driver who thought he had killed someone. And then ended up not, as in he was driving in the race, a similar situation where somebody has fallen. And a guy called Storr, let me find his first name.
Yes, yeah, I was trying to make sense of this as well, yeah.
Hit somebody because the facility is so cramped and everyone's kind of all over the place. And he braked so hard to try and not, but he hit him and then assumed he was dead on the spot. He miraculously wasn't, but Storr basically stopped to go check it out, like you might have seen in 76 Nürburgring with Lauda. The drivers start stopping their cars to try and help, and other drivers did the same because they saw a guy in need, and obviously one driver's stopped their car, so why wouldn't everyone else have stopped their car as well? This basically like caused mayhem in the race, with like four or five cars just stopped in the middle of the track to check out how this guy's doing. And they basically caused the right mess, as it were. But this marshal, who was knocked unconscious, but he managed to survive. And also, to add insult to injury, this is being broadcast on TV because they didn't have much TV broadcasting back then, but they did at this race. So all of this mess and toxicity and awfulness was all shown to the world.
Yeah. And as we say, obviously, you know, this was a really dark age for Formula One, wasn't it, back in the late 70s, early 80s, because there was so much politics that safety basically went out the window for quite a few dark years.
Yeah.
Which, of course, yeah, obviously, ultimately, Formula One did learn its lesson, and obviously things did get safer again, until, of course, we went back in the same direction in the early 90s, where cars got far too quick as well. But yeah, certainly, I think, a somber note, I think, to end this week's show. Unfortunately, we haven't even got any other news we can segue to, have we, Jamie?
Well, no. Liam Lawson, we already spoke about him.
We've mentioned that in a previous episode.
See it. Luca Badoa,
yes,
his son,
that's a
has
great
joined
point.
F3.
Yeah, I can't believe. I mean, it seems odd, doesn't it, that Luca Badoa, yeah, his son has signed up for F3 next year and is now officially a McLaren Junior as well, which I guess is a quite nice note to end, to obviously change it up.
Yeah, and Luca Badoa, famously the most races in Formula 1 without scoring a point.
I want to see his kids score a point.
I would be surprised. His three-letter initial is going to be bad. Which quite literally, which is a bit of a shame.
Have we got anything else to add?
We wish him all the best.
Yes, thank you, Azul.
Have we got anything else to add? We're still so far from racing.
Yeah,
we've got
one more iceberg coming next week for you all, which is probably going to be even worse than this one in terms of dark knowledge and things. So look forward to that next week, I guess.
Maybe this is our viewers' cup of tea. They're all.
If this video does really well, then yeah, we've got to be slightly concerned.
Yes.
But Jamie, as always, it has been a pleasure. Thank you, everybody, so much for listening. If you can find out more about Worldwide Racing as well, please do let us know down in the comments below, because that one really did stump both of us today. But yeah, we'll be back next week though with the final of the F1 icebergs, and then finally, racing in Texas will resume.